This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 24th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 194, with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield.
On today's show, we'll be talking magazines and how to make them Middle Eastern style with the publishers of Dubai-based Brown Book, Rashid and Ahmed bin Shabib.
We'll be freewheeling through ideas of cycling fancy with London's top pedal power planner, Andrew Gilligan, and with a new route set to cost £1 billion, some of those fancy ideas are becoming very real.
And we'll also be listening closely to broadcaster and sound specialist David Hendy about the history of sound itself.
That's all to come, plus the one, the only, Tom Edwards with next week's news agenda, and we'll spin a tune or two as well right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We made it, Steve. We're here on Sunday. How are we feeling? How's the week been?
It's been all right. It's nice to be back in London.
You sound a bit discombobulated. Well, Rob, it's a bit like, whoo, whoo. I thought you were going to say one of my favourite words, which is struth.
Struth?
Struth, Rob. Struth, Rob. It's a bit of an Australian isn't it?
Yeah, I haven't been in Australia. But you have been south of the equator.
Been robe fancying and forelock tugging in
robe
St. Peter's.
Fancying?
Robe fancying.
Robe fancying, yes.
You've been off to see Francis.
I did. Well, in fact, I got back from Sao Paulo and Brasilia.
Oh, yeah, of course you've been
only
there.
Just on Monday, Tuesday, and then went Monday, and then went to Rome on Tuesday to see His Holiness from a distance. Obviously, from a bit of a distance.
Just having a slurp of tea there. Sorry,
you just drink that tea. No, you drink that tea while I'm talking. Because I've got tea as well, so I'm going to wait until you're talking, and then I'll drink my tea.
I didn't realise. We have very sensitive microphones here in Studio One down here, and so I didn't realise it was going to be that. It was going to be that sensitive. Never mind. We can't edit it out now.
No,
it's too late. It's in there.
It's there. It's gone.
How was that? I know that we caught up with you on some of the live shows during the week when you're in Rome. So what was the vibe like? Was it very, very sort of celebratory?
Well, we thought, since it's a big occasion for Roman Catholics worldwide, that we should send a Jewish atheist to go and cover this big, important event. I think so, yeah. I could bring a sort of a neutral's eye view. Well, I don't know, am I neutral? Am I actually sort of, I'm biased the wrong way, maybe.
I think the Catholics and Jews have what might be called a
history.
A history. Let's put that history in inverted commas.
History.
I wrote a column for the website this week about how I thought that the news hadn't really been on their toes with this, and there was too much of a love-in. There wasn't.
He waved.
Yeah.
Oh, look, he said something in Italian.
It was very much like talking about the Queen or something. You know, it was very kind of like, you know, he kind of hands off the new boy kind of thing. And I felt that, you know, the world missed Christopher Hitchens somewhat and a bit of polemic in this kind of big love-in.
No one talked condoms, did they?
No one talked condoms. No one talked Africa. No one talked gays. It was all very much loving. Well, I guess we're going to welcome the one and the only Tom Edwards. I can hear him tapping on his crystal ball. Or is it a snow globe? I can never tell. We're having a bit of a long winter here. Up next on the Weekly, Tom Edwards.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his Weekly Look Ahead.
Welcome, Tom Edwards, to the Monocle Weekly. The more I hear that theme tune, your theme tune, I'm kind of thinking that we're kind of, especially the three of us in here today, feels very much like we should be doing like a football phone-in or something.
Is that not what we're doing?
I'd like to introduce that formally today.
I've got Dave from Slough on the line. He's angry about Rafa Benitez.
Sandy from Brentford. Do you think anyone from Brentford is called Sandy? Is that possible?
Invariably.
Okay. My favourite person from Brentford, Nick Lowe.
Is he from Brentford?
Well, he's done his last three albums were called the Brentford Trilogy, which I think is just what a wonderful idea. The fact that Brentford has had a trilogy written about it and for it.
Yeah, is it better than the New York Trilogy?
Are we talking Paul Auster?
Yeah.
Yeah. Auster, Lowe, two of my faves. Anyway, that isn't sport.
No, but here with the sport.
All the sport, it's Tony Cork.
Well, today, former Pakistan president returning from self-imposed exile to run elections. You'll like this one, Steve. Mm. It's our old friend, General Pervez Musharraf.
Oh, Perv?
He's back. despite arrest warrants, various other problems in conspiracy with, you know, connection with some conspiracies of one sort and another, yeah. alleged assassination attempts and that sort of thing. He's been living in Dubai, London for a spell since resigning. He's coming back.
You know where he was living before? Like, just down the road.
Yeah, Edgeway around
road,
the corner.
Around the corner.
Was he?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he had a three-bedroom apartment on off the Edgeway Road.
Okay.
He's filled up with shawarma sandwiches from Edgeway Road, and now he wants people's votes. So he's going back.
It's funny in a sense that, I mean, it's not funny, but I mean, it's funny strange in that it's a good thing about Pakistan that a former military ruler wants power again, but is trying to get back via the ballot box and not via the barrel of the gun.
Absolutely.
There wow. Bit of analysis
that's
there.
That's quite profound.
That was very profound. I'm just going to write that down. I'm not really.
Right, okay.
I'm just going to mime writing it down.
Okay, I'm going to drink my tea now.
Is slurp, that... slurp your tea. You can...
Sorry. Oh,
dear. Come on, Tom. Where's it going next? Where are we going next?
Let's run through. We'll dance between some kind of geopolitics and a bit of culture. So the Bologna Children's Book Fair, that's mm-hmm. tomorrow. This is the key event in the world of children's literary publishing. Kind of like the Frankfurt event. For junior.
Okay. How lovely. What a lovely event that must be. That sounds fascinating.
Absolutely. And I think we might be picking it up during the week on March the 24th.
That sounds like a good idea.
Exactly. But let's, you know, that's enough on that.
And also, presumably, a mega market. Presumably, if it's got a book fair all of its own. I mean,
that's
it's
right.
huge. Everyone's presumably it's trying to find the next Quidditch.
That's it. And it's a very interesting kind of, as they promise, a cross-cultural atmosphere. I literally don't know what that means.
Do you think that just translates very poorly from Italian?
That is a possible.
A cross-cultural atmosphere.
Let's get some more...
Like men in dresses?
Possibly.
Okay, we're talking about the Pope again. What's number three on your news agenda?
Let's have some more geopolitics. Tuesday, a BRICS summit.
Mm.
Not House BRICS, Rob. Come on.
Not Samantha Brick, the model that was so good-looking that she had to write about how good-looking she was in the Daily Mail.
And moved to France to escape the people's vitriol. No, it's the BRICS. Brazil, Russia, China, India, and our old friend South Africa. This is taking place in South Africa. And they're talking about economic union. I think this is quite interesting, Steve. Is there any need for the BRICS?
No.
Next there item.
What do you mean, is there any need for them?
It's an acronym made up by a guy who worked at Goldman Sachs. And it caught a zeitgeist, and it sort of certainly helped. And they very much like it in Brazil. Because it's suddenly people think of them as an emerging economic power rather than just, you know, sun, sea, samba, soccer.
But the Brazilians will follow any kind of diplomatic suggestion that people make to them, won't they?
That is true.
I mean, it's probably someone in this room. Oh, it's already happened. Steve Bloomfield, international diplomatic emissary.
I think my problem is that the Brazil, Sweden, Turkey thing that we helped, well, not create, but sort of suggested, doesn't have a good acronym.
Yeah, what you need to think of is not whether the powers politically, economically, socially... should and will converge, but you need to think of your acronym first.
Just get Uganda involved and then it can be BUST.
I was thinking we should get Indonesia and Oman, so it's MBISTO.
I think you should have China, Oceania and Korea, COC.
Do we have any more news, Tom?
Well, no, we're talking cock on the weekly, as always. What should we do next? Do you want geopolitics or more culture?
We're doing so well
culture.
With geopolitics.
Well, it's a big week. Let's look at film festivals. I know Rob frequently swaps the office for the film festival floor. Friday, the European Independent Film Festival mm-hmm. is taking place in Paris, France. They bill themselves modestly as the Sundance of Europe.
Wow.
Is that a bit big-headed to sort of say that yourself?
Well, maybe it's better than Sundance, I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether it kind of is, but I guess you need one of these kind of umbrella terms so that people kind of know what you're doing, they know the vibe, it's the independent thing, la, la, la. But maybe they should have it in the hills of France rather than in Paris, right?
Mm. Possibly. But they've got 90 independent films presented this year from...
The Utah of Europe.
From 28 countries, exactly.
Love it, yeah.
And they're particularly into providing a platform for sort of, as they call it, risk-taking storytellers. So that's got to be welcome.
That's good.
Yeah.
And we should support our European filmmaking buddies.
Well, on which subject, this is my final one, Saturday, the end of the week, the International Istanbul Film Festival, the biggest in Turkey, of course. It's been taking place since 1982, celebrating Turkish film production, a growing area, and a really sort of rich forum for film chat.
Turkish film, amazing as well. I wonder if they will fall under the auspices also of the European Film Festival.
Maybe there'll be a
culturally
renegade faction.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you never quite know whether you're in or out of Europe. But also, Turkey, one of the amazing kind of soft power players with their film industry as well.
Absolutely.
I think we're going to be seeing lots of Turkish pop. Let's get some Turkish pop in.
We should do that.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, yeah. Why not?
Let's do it. So I think we're all agreed, though. We will broach this with the management of the radio station, the sports phone in. Maybe it's a Saturday afternoon.
I think that's what Tom was saying. I think Charlie from Plymouth is on the line.
All right, as ever, Tom Edwards, thank you very much for coming in and giving your news roundup. When it comes to the Middle East, we're often aware of the big stories, the mega skyscrapers, the man-made islands, the renewed sense of political awareness that's making it one of the most volatile yet opportune periods in the region's history.
But what about the nuances of North African diplomacy? Or that amazing store in Riyadh, or a tucked away restaurant in Gaza? We don't hear quite so much about the smaller stories that make the region tick. And it's these that our first guests, brothers Ahmed and Rashid bin Shabib, have been highlighting since 2006. They're publishers of current affairs and culture title Brown Book, based in Dubai.
And they join us today to tell us a little more about getting pages to print in the Middle East and North Africa. Rashid and Ahmed, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much for having us.
Sabah al khair. I think I can say that. I think it's the right time of day. Now, what's the publishing reality of working out of the Middle East, of working out of Dubai? Brown Book's 38 issues old. We've got the handsome Middle East Museums issue in front of us. Yeah. Tell us about the genesis of it and where you're at now.
Me and Ahmed have always had a passion for publishing, but in particular, we've always had this perspective that we've always wanted to readdress global stereotypes about the Middle East. It's something that's been very close to us, and we've married the two to have a look at how publishing can help us. I mean, talk about an art gallery in Saudi, or talk about skiing in Tehran, or an Oscar Niemeyer's building in Constantine, Algeria. You're looking at all of these interesting topics that you wouldn't read about or wouldn't find anywhere else in a publication dedicated to contemporary Middle East. So, I mean, this is where the sort of idea came 5 years ago, and it was a difficult 2-3 years in the beginning. We didn't know how to start. We didn't know the intricacies of publishing, and regional distribution is just a nightmare. Trying to get global suppliers to come on board, we've done all the mistakes that anybody can do in publishing.
Give us some examples then of sort of the problems of distributing.
The biggest challenge that you have is with the world global distribution of publishing breaking down, you feel like weeklies are disappearing, you feel like dailies are disappearing, you feel like monthlies are facing challenges. So you feel like a publication has to be treated as product placement rather than global distribution. I mean, yes, it's important to be in the airports, ports, selective shops. I think what Monocle has been doing, I mean, globally, whether it's Tokyo or Hong Kong or Singapore, you find it well taken care of, whether it's in a fantastic modern hair salon or a progressive shop focusing on these things. This is where publication should be, not in the back shop in a gas station. So
I mean, just getting your product to the market you want is not always easy, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest challenges is you have to sort of give in to these huge logistical operations, and you have to tell them, we've got this fantastic magazine focusing on contemporary culture of Middle East and North Africa. We want it to be in these kind of shops. We want them to be here. And it goes over their head. They couldn't care less. They shove it everywhere. I mean, one of the biggest challenges, what I was mentioning earlier, is trying to get into Saudi or trying to get into these markets. Because of the intricacies and complications of ministries of information and that sort of thing, we have to end up sending it globally and say that we're an international-based publication that gets resent back to places. So that, I mean, we're very much politically neutral. We've got a very cultural and arts mandate to what we try to do. So,
but rather than shipping it from Dubai straight to Jeddah,
which is basically a 6-hour ride, so it's very complicated. So we have to send it to Paris, which takes 2 days.
I've got my distribution model. People scoffed at me at first when I suggested this, but I think it's a wonderful idea. Roll it up, put it in a bottle, chuck it in the sea. It's the only way to get stuff out there. Everyone jokes, you know. You chuck it into the right current.
Yeah. The way publications are heading is more of not only a product placement, but people are looking at it more of your brand representation or brand extension. So how would I want to experience my product elsewhere, whether it's in Singapore or whether it's in Tokyo? So not only finding the right place, but positioning it within the right environment and making sure the right people have access to it is key, and rather than giving it to a distributor who's going to chuck it in a corner you're not aware
absolutely.
of.
Absolutely. I mean, our mandate with this publication is to make sure that when people... we're trying to break this global stereotype about the region, and there's no better way than finding this cool guy that's leading visual arts in Beirut that can be comparable to a kid in Brick Lane or that an artist in Soho. So we're trying to show that sort of comparison. So, I mean, being at the Serpentine is important. Being at the Tate, being at Whitechapel is important. I don't know how important it would be for us to be in a gas station.
I wanted to ask you about the editorial. We'll go from distribution. We'll go from crates and trucks and ships and planes to the words and pictures on the page. You mentioned some of those, some typical sort of editorial ideas at the top of this chat. How focused or how slanted are these stories for your international readers and your diaspora readers? Because you can't be, you're sort of preaching to the choir in a sense, but you I guess if a British or an American publication might do some of these stories, they go, would you believe it? There's this wonderful building in so-and-so, and it's very patronising way of looking at the Middle East. I guess that's one of the stereotypes you're trying to break. But how much knowledge do you expect of your readers of the scene?
I mean, one of the things that Ahmed constantly says, and I believe it to be true, is that we're not only trying to reintroduce the Middle East to the world, but we're also trying to reintroduce the Middle East to itself. You have a lot of fantastic, talented Tunisian bankers or designers or creative individuals in that industry, but they do too lack the knowledge about what's going on in Dubai or Sharjah or Muscat or Tehran. So you feel like that
K-pop has done it phenomenally, and building off what, you know, Japanese contemporary pop culture has done. Globalization has hit the Gulf, and in particular the United Arab Emirates, at a very latent stage. And the region has a lot of youth. You know, when you look at a chair, I visually identify it as being a Danish chair, but what does an Emirati chair look like?
Yeah.
What does an Omani building look like? So we're trying to, maybe not find the answers, but ask the right questions. So what does it mean for the next generation, and how do we make it relevant for the future?
I mean, that's a very good issue that, we've done a bit of research on it, and it focuses on, what is a modern museum? What's the new definition of a museum? Is Saatchi Gallery defined as a museum? Is it just... We don't know the answers. But what we do is we pose questions like Salt Art Gallery in Istanbul or Dar al-Ma'mun in Marrakesh or... Ahmed Al Gallery in Saudi? Al-An Gallery in Saudi.
Athar Gallery in Jeddah.
Athar Gallery, Mohammed's Gallery in Jeddah.
So you look at these people and what they're doing, so it's free to the public, people can experience a bit of art, there's a bit of lectures. So is that the definition of the modern museum? So we pose these questions and we see... And we leave it at that and see how people react.
What's written on the cover? Al-Mataḥif al-Jadīda fi al-Sharq al-Awsat?
Al-Mataḥif al-Haditha. So basically it says modern museum. And this
modern
is
museums in the Middle East.
And this is a very talented calligrapher. Her name is Aziza. She's Pakistani based in Qatar. And what she's done is she's done this sort of hieroglyphic...
This is a real riff on Arabic. It's sort of on Arabic, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
It looks like how Korean is written compared to sort of Chinese.
Yeah, exactly.
So
kind of kanji.
So it's these things that we play
and
on.
And also this reinforces the idea of what does, you know, no one's looking at contemporary typography in the region. So everyone's looking at this kind of calligraphy, writing, and it's very kind ancient and thinking. So we're working with her to reintroduce modern contemporary typography for the future. And we're doing that in different logos and the different spaces we're working on as well.
And without a doubt, I think no matter what people say about publishing and magazines, it is still the most powerful medium. We get this email and we get the strap line all the time. It says, I now see the Middle East with new eyes. I don't think I can do that. I can send this publication to a guy's desk in Williamsburg and he's sitting there and he's flipping through the pages and he gets to experience the Middle East and North Africa without visiting it. There's no other way, I think.
How important is it for you to be changing attitudes in, say, Williamsburg compared to, say, just opening people's eyes within the Middle East itself, whether that's a young guy in Riyadh who's never been to Dubai and doesn't really, you know what's going on outside Saudi? I mean, which for you, deep down in your heart, is the sort of the most important audience?
That's a very good question. I think it's the person that's willing to accept it. I think there are some people that come to Dubai and live this expat sort of lifestyle for years and years, and they never dig in deep. And it's such a shame, and it's very sad for both him and the local population, because there's a parallel life that is sort of almost superficial.
But also both are important. I mean, to talk about what the next generation are doing for a global audience is important because it moves beyond the oil, the political instability issues, the basic stereotypes that exist. But also at the same time, we have to reinforce this role modeling concept that people like Silicon Valley have been able to do by creating a whole tech industry, but also saying, look, what are the people in the region doing that are interesting? And someone can look at the magazine and say, this person has done something interesting and I can make a difference.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, both of you guys, about that specifically, because you were entrepreneurs. You started a business called Brown Bag, which was promised to get anything to anyone in Dubai within an hour. Yeah. Great idea. Yeah. And that was obviously very successful for you. I guess you launched Brown Bag with some of the dosh you made from that. But I wondered about that. That's a great story to come out of the Middle East. A lot of people have this, especially in the Emirates as well, have this silly idea of that everyone's an heir to a fortune. And there are presumably a lot of entrepreneurs like you.
I mean, for us, I say this all the time. I find myself closer to a Singaporean or a Hong Kong or than somebody from Saudi or Egypt, yeah. Because we've gone through a very sort of similar global boom, and we've realized that within this context, we have to do initiatives that will preserve and amplify who we truly are, or we'll end up becoming this globalized city that has very little details about it.
We go to Singapore a lot, and we visit Hong Kong and Tokyo, and that generation, or let's say the generation of Asians, I tell Rashid, thank God the Middle East is in Asia, but but I think, you know, thinking through the region, this generation will have to inevitably find a way to inject its identity into globalization, whether it's the dish dash that we wear or whether it's the Arabic language or modern typography, rather than allowing globalization to engross our identity.
Do you think Dubai struggled with that? It still does feel a lot of time like a sort of a global city that really could be anywhere.
I think with Dubai, and I think their priorities are clearly just to jumpstart that economy. All they want to do is make sure that they've got a service-based economy that can make that money. Like, arts and culture isn't what they want to focus on. They want to focus on building that economy and making it function and proper roads, good airline, good service, hotels, that sort of thing, conferences. And I think that's what they should do. I mean, and this is what we should be doing. We should be launching these initiatives. Some will fail, some will work. Publication is the key of what we do. We've got a couple of other spaces that we work with different partners on. We work with a partner called Amar, which is a real estate developer, and we work with them to create a public space that focuses on contemporary art. We work with the parks, and we've created the small public library on a consult. We work with different partners, but there's nothing more powerful.
And the beauty is the government actually steps aside to let the private sector take a hold of this space and develop it.
It's a funny thing, you know, having you guys in, because I guess I get a lot of press releases about culture and arts, art especially in the Middle East and in Dubai and in the Emirates. And that's what I associate with it, because I think the Emirates has done such a good job. You guys, Art Dubai, the Sharjah Biennial, and people like Jack Posecki when he was there, do such a good job of branding this that I don't think necessarily of business. I don't think of Emirates Airlines or Etihad. I actually think of, only when I'm thinking about football sponsorship, I associate it with culture. So I think the job is being done kind of quite well, but I guess it can always be refined.
For us, honestly, I mean, press releases and that whole world of PR machine, yes, it's important, but I mean, we've got kids on the ground that are Middle Eastern, whether they're from Dubai or Abu Dhabi or Jeddah or Beirut or Marrakesh. All of these kids that are coming and making the city their home. So it has
very important also. Well, about the next. So how do we make things relevant for the next generation, and how do we create that so that it's more relevant for the future?
Yeah.
That will be presumably in an upcoming issue of Brown Book, issue 38, Modern Museums of the Middle East, with that beautiful calligraphy or typography on the cover is out now. Rashid and Ahmed bin Shabib, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to be getting on our bikes in a minute, but before that, we'll stay in the region with some music from Algeria. This is Saoud Massi with O Khouria. It means liberty.
Chanter d'éternelles histoires, des soleils tombés, des lunes pleines, des nuits noires, et sur le bord des lacs où dorment des songes brûlés.
That was O Khouria by Saoud Massi, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield. All right, welcome back to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The name Andrew Gilligan may be a familiar one to some of our listeners. As a journalist back in 2003, it was his now infamous claim that the UK government's intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction had been sexed up that helped kick off a political scandal that still reverberates today.
But now Andrew's got a different job. He's the City of London's cycling commissioner, or the cycling czar, as some might say. He's now responsible for the planning of cycle routes, and with a £900 million project recently announced, touted to turn London into a pedal power paradise, it might be time for cyclists to start getting excited.
He joined Rob a little earlier to tell us more.
Andrew, thanks for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. The new London's new cycling czar, Now, well, that's an often overused monarchical term, but kind of roughly, what does that mean? What are your responsibilities? Who's your boss?
I asked for a uniform, preferably with epaulettes, but they said no.
Damn. You need a big sort of... I need a big sort of Russian beard as well, possibly.
Pretty much. And the power of instant execution, that would be nice.
That would be nice. Absolute. Absolute Gilligan.
Not all the traditional powers of the office were available to me, but I have got what is called oversight over the TFL cycling programme and budget. And I basically wrote the city cycling policy, which is published about 10 days ago. Uh-huh. The Mayor's Vision for Cyclists, I wrote that very largely. And at the moment, I'm... you know, reasonably pleased with how it's going, but it's very early days. It's all, you know, it's words on paper at the moment. We've got to make sure it's delivered.
And one of the headlines of it, one of the most sort of quotable words from that words on paper, is this Crossrail for cycling. Maybe you can tell us about what that is. Obviously, Londoners will know, and visitors to London who listen to this show from overseas will know that a lot of London's being dug up at the moment for Crossrail, which is an actual railway thing. This is a humongous cycle lane that goes from east to west, north to south. What's Crossrail for bikes?
That's right. It's going to be the longest, we think, the longest substantially segregated urban cycleway in Europe. It's going to run for at least 15 miles from the western suburbs of London, right through the heart of the West End and the city, out to Canary Wharf and Barking. And basically what we're doing is we're creating a whole series of routes based on tube lines, which will run in rough parallel to tube lines. And of course, across the middle of the real tube map from 2018 will run this giant railway called Crossrail. And so we're going to create a really fantastic segregated lane all the way through the middle of London.
When you say segregated, you mean going both ways?
Substantially segregated, yeah. I mean, essentially what it's going to be...
Not for fast and slow people.
No, essentially segregated means it's separated from the motor traffic. On Victoria Embankment, for instance, we're going to install a curb between the cycle lane and the rest of the road, so motorists can't get into it. We're going to do similar things in the city. We're going to do something similar on the Westway flyover. The Westway flyover, if people who know London know it, it's this huge planning mistake of the 1960s and 70s.
But now it's a sort of romantic thing, isn't it? It's been romanticised a lot in song.
Has it really?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. I mean, that was going to be my question, whether these cycle lanes can ever be as romantic. Maybe a bit of doomed glamour, but the glamour of the Westway.
When I look at the Westway, I see this kind of disgusting concrete disaster that completely destroyed a neighbourhood of London and a symbol of all the failed urban policies to promote the car. Now, in central London, the car is actually a relatively minor form of transport, and all we're doing is reflecting that. We are this symbol of how the inner city was torn up for the sake of the car in the 1960s is going to be turned into a symbol of how we are claiming the centre of London for the bike.
Yes, it was kind of the hero of J.G. Ballard's Concrete Island, the Westway, as well.
Okay,
about a guy who's crashed his jag off.
So romantic.
I thought
Doom glamour. All right, okay, that's the important, the D word in front there.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
You know, I think I saw an 80s pop video done on the Westway once as well.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think that involved a crash as well. So there's obviously
there's a lot of that stuff
death.
Going on.
You know, it's associated with death in the artistic mind.
You need to, whoever the new Clash, to write a song about your bike lanes, and then it will be immortalised. You mentioned the tube map, Andrew, and from reading an earlier interview with you about this, you talked about tapping into people's mental maps of London.
That's
which
right.
is a very important thing, because bike lanes don't follow necessarily the roads. So tell us about how that works, because the tube, I guess, is how a lot of people think how London is set up.
That's right. I mean, one of the key problems about cycling is you don't know where the cycle lanes go and you don't know what they mean. And, you know, I was trying to get here, for instance, from Southwark to just north of Oxford Street, and I had to sort of figure it out. In the end, I went along lots of rather nasty main roads, which I shouldn't have needed to do, because there should have been there is actually a tube line called the Jubilee Line that goes up pretty much from Southwark to Bond Street.
Yeah.
And we're going to create what we call a Jubilee Line quiet way on quiet routes roughly parallel to the Jubilee Line. And you get on there and you follow it, and you know, you get on at Southwark, say, you know the next place is going to be Waterloo, the place after that is going to be Westminster, the place after that is going to be Green Park. Everyone knows where the underground goes, or at least where their bit of it goes. And that's the idea of the tube network for the bike. They're not going to be precisely parallel to the tube lines. They'll be roughly parallel. And not all the routes will be named after tube lines. Some of them will follow bus routes instead.
So they're going to have names. It's going to be a proper...
Yeah, there is going to be something called the Jubilee Line quite a way. If you look at the Jubilee Line in northwest London, for instance, starts out in Stanmore, goes down through Wembley, through West Hampstead, Kilburn, that kind of area, into Baker Street. And they're actually actually there is quite a nice parallel side street running beside that line for most of the way. And so you get on it there and you know where you're going to go next. And that's really important in allowing people to use the system. And so, you know, you get on the Jubilee Line Quiet Way at West Hampstead, you know it will take you to Baker Street, and then at Baker Street you will change to the Circle Line Quiet Way, and that'll get you to King's Cross or something like that. That's how it's going to work.
And this is an interesting thing, because this is literally making it a route. There's still something, I say still something, there's definitely still something about being a cyclist in London and being having to be trained in the art of survival slightly,
yeah.
Which is why cyclists can be very militant, aggressive characters sometimes.
It's very Darwinian. Darwinian. I want to make it a bit more social democratic. the idea is to get it a bit more like, it's never exactly like it is in Amsterdam or Copenhagen or any of those other cities where it's a huge part of the transport mix, where, you know, a third of all journeys are made by bike. In London, it's 2%. But it's going to be more like that. I want people cycling fairly slowly on fairly clunky bikes in their ordinary clothes without high vis and helmets if they don't
want
to.
You said something like, or maybe Boris Johnson said that he wanted to de-likeify
cycling. Absolutely, because right? At the moment, it's something that you feel you have to kind of suit up for. You have to kind of, you know, get your helmet on, get your visor on, get your body armour maybe even. I've seen people with that. Get
like they're going jousting rather than cycling.
And I understand why people feel like that at the moment. We want to try to create routes that will allow them to cycle differently. And so a lot of these quiet way routes will not be segregated. They'll use side streets mostly. London isn't like a lot of continental cities. It hasn't got the kind of sort of dictators' boulevards of Berlin or anywhere like. It wasn't rebuilt massively in the 19th century like Paris was by Haussmann. It's still got its old medieval street pattern, but it's got something better than Grand Boulevard. It's got this matchless network of side streets, parks, canal towpaths. All of those are going to be included in our Quiet Way network, and it's actually possible to get to almost anywhere from anywhere in London on side streets if you only knew how, and if you tackled a few of the major problem junctions that you can't avoid. And that's basically what we're going to do. I came back from King's Cross on Monday night to my home in Greenwich, distance of about 10 miles, without touching a main road. And
that's the secret, isn't it?
That's the secret.
The secret is being able to do that without checking your iPhone, your Google Maps.
You have a signposted route that'll take you to where you want to go. That's the idea.
And you mentioned Amsterdam and Copenhagen. I mean, we know from our quality of life surveys here at Monocle magazine and stuff that they're two kind of cycling heroes. But what about some towns that are the same size as London? What about New York? Because that's not mega bike friendly. It is kind of downtown by the Hudson and stuff. But were there cities of comparable size to London?
The thing is, I don't think there's anywhere that compares to London. And I think even the big world cities, like comparable size and important type cities like New York and Tokyo, are so different. It's difficult to compare. I mean, New York has put in a lot more bike lanes recently. In Manhattan, they've got a lot of very wide avenues, six, seven lanes, one way, nearly all one way, and there's room for bike lanes. We haven't got that here. We had to be a bit more creative. We are going to put segregated tracks in on some roads like the Victoria Embankment, the West Way I described. A lot of the time, though, we're not going to be able to manage that because the roads are too narrow, too crowded, too full of buses, too full of delivery shops and so on. So we're going to have to use alternative ways. But what we are determined to do is create a real network that joins up and that offers a kind of choice of routes. You can have a kind of fast route for confident cyclists in Lycra, or you can have a slower, calmer, more traffic-free route in along side streets or in segregated parts on main roads, where the likes of middle-aged or elderly women would be happy to cycle. Yeah. Where Dutch style cycling can be done.
And where do you fit into all of this? Because you're talking about this with obviously a lot of experience on two wheels. Have you always been a cyclist?
No, I took it up in 2006 to lose weight. I did lose an enormous amount of weight. I used to be 17 stone. I'm 13 now.
Lycra hangs off Andrew Gillingham.
Never shall an inch of Lycra touch my body. That's one of the reasons I think I'm qualified, because I think I understand what gets people cycling and what keeps them cycling, what nearly puts them off cycling, because I've done that journey and I just want more people to take the journey that I've done.
And finally, cycling's a very emotive issue for a lot of people, for motorists and for cyclists and for pedestrians as well. It's a busy city, everyone's muscling their way to their own little square inch of pavement or road, whatever it is. How are you sort of finding the scales of justice as cycling's are? How many different points of view are having to juggle all the time?
One of the arguments we've got to make is that improving cycling is not just about benefiting cyclists. Improving cycling will benefit everybody, whether or not they have any intention of getting on a bicycle. It means less traffic, it means less pollution, pollution, air pollution in London kills 2,000 to 4,000 people every single year. And there's some striking statistics that if we got even a 14% modal share for cycling in central London, which is totally doable, it's 4 or 5% already, then if we got that level of share, then we could reduce deadly air pollutants by almost a third. And that would save literally hundreds of lives in the years ahead. So the answer to a lot of people who say we don't like cyclists, they're aggressive, they ride on the pavement, is twofold. Firstly, we want to kind of like de-likeify them, de-aggressivize them, and if that's a word. And and you know, one of the reasons they cycle on the pavement is we haven't given them good enough places to cycle on the road. The other thing we say is look, this is about making life better for everyone. It means less traffic. It means less competition for a parking space. It means fewer bodies on the tube in the mornings. It means more places to sit and eat a sandwich. It means traffic, cars and traffic that no longer dominate London as they do now.
That was Rob talking to London Cycling Commissioner Andrew Gilligan.
We'll be keeping an ear out for David Hendy next, who's been documenting the history of noise.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
We make rather a lot of noise here on Monocle 24, and we hope that the vast majority is refined broadcasting for your listening pleasure.
But we don't always get it right, and what amounts to good sound or noise has always been on the mind of our final guest, the broadcaster and historian Professor David Hendy. He's been travelling around the world trying to pin down that elusive and at times most intrusive of the senses, noise itself, and trying to make some historical sense of our relationship with it. He's documented his journey in a new book aptly titled Noise, and a radio series of the same name.
He met Rob earlier in the relative peace and quiet of Monocle's Studio One.
David, thanks for joining us on The Weekly. Now, this is a fascinating subject, obviously for a book, but even more obviously for a radio show, and it's on Radio 4 in lots of parts, right?
Yes, 30 episodes, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. We should kick off this discussion, I think, by asking you to define noise. John Cage defines it in your book, but yes. I wonder if you can better him. Or
I'm not sure. I actually think there's a bit of a problem in trying to over-define things. I quite like the idea of it being a little bit loose and a little bit vague. But I suppose some people have thought of noise as being a bit like dirt, being something like matter out of place, and noise is a sound that's out of place. And I think that's true, but I also think of noise as something like a sound that someone somewhere doesn't want to be heard, and therefore includes the idea of dispute and tension. Yeah. It's noise is something like a sound that people might disagree over. It doesn't have to be unpleasant particularly, but it has that dramatic element of something fought over in some way.
And that's a very elegant definition of it. And in Cage's definition, I think he sort of says it's something that's unwanted unless you listen to it. And then it becomes possibly musical.
That's right. Possibly musical or possibly meaningful in a broader sense, because even though music is part of the story, this obviously isn't a history of music. It's a history of sound more generally. And that idea of John Cage about listening, I think, is really, really important, because there's a whole history going back centuries of certain sounds being dismissed as noise. And I suppose one classic example is explorers or colonists in, say, the 16th or the 17th century who settled in North America or Australia or wherever it was, Africa, and generally dismissed the sounds that were made by, for instance, Native Americans as just noise, as wild, as savage, and so on. And all the different complex languages and sounds and musics of Native peoples were essentially being leveled down into an amorphous concept of noise, which is the prelude to them being basically dismissed as meaningless.
Well, this is an interesting thing, that noise is the meaningless bit of sound, I guess. Do you think the edges have been smoothed off noise, and therefore other areas of noise come forward? I mean, obviously, now in the 21st century, as we dealt with throughout the 20th, when I walk down a London street, I can often not hear my friend talking or have a phone conversation because there's so much noise, and this is traffic noise, this is combustion engine stuff going on. But the idea of, and the definition of noise changed with different eras?
It has changed, but of course there's lots of continuities as well. So you give the example of the motor car and walking through London. Of course, traffic noise is a defining sound of the 20th and the 21st centuries. Motor cars, taxis, lorries, and so on. What's really interesting is that when the motor car first arrived in the early 20th century, it was seen as a solution to city noise because the previous noise of the city had been the very, very loud clattering hooves. Of iron-rimmed wheels and hooves on cobbles. And so cars come along and they have rubberized wheels. And then you have tarmacked roads. And that seems at first much quieter. And indeed it is. And what makes it noisy is then that the engines get louder, the traffic gets busier, and there are just more and more cars. So it doesn't always have a continuous story of the world getting noisier. I think that's something which, when you look at the history of sound and noise specifically, you realise that actually there are lots of interesting ebbs and flows, and the past was probably noisier than we imagine.
And presumably, there's hardly... I mean, we're in a soundproof radio studio doing this, but I presume it's made you notice, or maybe you noticing it was the genesis of the book in the first place, that there is kind of no such thing as silence.
There is no such thing as silence. And when people find silence, I mean, there are people who go in search of silence for particular reasons. For instance, people will go to religious retreats and they are seeking silence as a means of finding the voice of God, say. But actually, in the secular world, as it were, silence is actually very, very difficult to find. And for the secular world, silence is actually slightly unsettling when you experience it. Not just in a perfectly soundproof studio like this one, but anything that approaches it. And I suppose the classic tale is the writer Thomas Carlyle in the 19th century, who was so fed up with the noise in the street and the noise from the rest of his household while he tried to write, that he built himself a special designed soundproof study in the attic. And he thought, well, once I've got that, it's going to be great. I won't have any windows. I'll have double sealed walls. I'll have just a skylight. It'll be fantastic. And it was an utter disaster, not just because the ventilation system actually sucked in sounds from the rest of the house, but because once he'd actually established peace and quiet, this hush, every slight sound suddenly stood out, and all the sounds that had been concealed against this background emulsion of sound were suddenly revealed. So actually what we find very often is that people who seek silence end up being even more sensitive to noise, and actually it's a sort of fool's errand.
So one man's music is another man's noise. I guess this is one of the stories of the book as well.
That's right. And, you know, in my own household, and this I think will be something that other people will recognise, as far as my son is concerned, the music I play is not music, it is noise.
So I love this. This is a strange and uncommon dynamic, that your son complains about your music, not the other way around.
Yes, he does. And he complains about the volume of the music as well. And that's...
It's too loud?
It's too loud. I mean, my teenage son will ask me to turn the music down. And the reason he wants me to turn it down is because he doesn't like the music. So the music sounds louder to him.
And it sounds like noise.
Yeah. And that subjective aspect to it is really important, because we do genuinely regard things as louder if we don't like them than if we like them.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? We've got to ask you what you're playing, by the way. Come on.
I was playing some music that I actually picked up in Ghana when I was doing some field recording for the series. And it was by someone called Reggie Rockstone. and I was interested in his
music.
He
needs to be more famous than he is with a name like that.
He does. And yeah. this was a CD that was made in the 1990s, and it's an interesting Ghanaian musical genre that we talk about in the series and in the book called Hip Life, which is an interesting fusion of American hip-hop and African
and
rhythms
life,
and high life, exactly. And listening to the different traditions of music in Ghana, you get a sense of the history, specifically of the relationship between West Africa and America. In other words, the slave trade and the way in which recorded music and musical traditions have followed the old routes established by the slave trade. And that, I think, for me, is a really good example of a genre of music which, if you don't listen to, you might dismiss as noise in some way. But if you do listen to it in that John Cage way, you don't just enjoy the music more, but you actually get a sense of the history that lies behind that music.
So it's like a record being like the rings of a tree, being able to sort of trace it back and see how old it is and where it came from.
Yes, exactly.
I wanted to ask you, now you've brought up the subject of your sound recordings and going out in the field, you mentioned Ghana. One man that you mentioned in the radio programme on Radio 4 is Bernie Krause, who's a legendary sound recordist. I wondered whether you or he, working together, have played any... You bring back sounds from Ghana, you bring back sounds from jungles and far-off places. Do you ever play the sounds of 21st century London or New York City, for example, to them?
That's a really interesting idea. I'm feeling really bad now, but I don't. What a fantastic idea. There is an interesting tension there because, I mean, I'm a huge admirer of Bernie Krause's work. And in fact, we draw on his work in some of our programmes. And he's helped us achieve a particular rainforest mix in one example. Yeah. So there are some beautiful, beautiful sound recordings. But we're interested in Noise, A Human History. That's the title of the book and the radio series. And what that means is that we complicate matters because a lot of people who are gathering the sounds of the world are focused very much on the kind of sounds that they fear might be being lost. Natural soundscapes, wilderness sounds, the jungle, the rainforest, the savannah, the polar regions and so on. And that's a very, very precious and important process. But we're interested in the sounds generated by humans. And sometimes the sounds generated by humans have a relationship with the natural world. And there's one episode, one chapter called The Singing Wilderness, where we look at the way in which human language evolved from the sounds being made by animals and respond to the sounds of things like the rain forest. But there's certainly a tradition in the sound studies field and the sound recordist field which is suspicious of modernity and suspicious of urban life. And I don't quite share that. I mean, I find just as interesting the fact that you move from city to city and every ambulance sounds different and distinctive. Yeah. And to me, that's almost the equivalent of a landscape or a soundscape sounding distinctive. So I think city life can be just as rich and interesting as, say, the jungle.
What's your favourite siren? I love the Italian police sirens.
I do. I love that too.
That's a nice one.
I love it. And one of the reasons which I think it has an appeal is that it doesn't quite fit modernity. It's got a slightly archaic feel, and it's also got a slightly homemade feel to it.
Yeah. The music in it seems less accidental somehow.
And because of that, I think it almost feels more human. I think that siren is almost like a voice in a way that actually a really loud, very modern siren is sort of stripped almost of the humanity that you might hear in other sirens.
That was Rob speaking to Professor David Hendy, author of a new book, Noise.
And that's kind of all we've got time for today, Steve.
Is it?
Yeah.
No.
You disappointed?
A little.
It was quite a good show. I enjoyed it.
I'm
in a good mood today. I don't know why. I'm just feeling good. It's good.
It's a good Sunday.
Yeah.
Despite the weather outside being a little bit... What happened to spring?
I don't know, I feel like I'm going to say something like, whatever we say about the weather, it's going to end in on record. The crappiest winter on record, I think we could possibly safely say. I don't know whether that's necessarily strictly a meteorological term.
The Met Office do say that.
crappy.
Yeah. It's a bit crappy outside today.
It reminds me of the weather forecast in Good Morning Vietnam. It's going to be hot and pissy in Hanoi. And it's kind of that, but cold.
Yeah.
So it was good stuff. It was interesting meeting Andrew Gilligan. As we said before we turned on the mics, we didn't sort of, although we put Iraq in the introduction to him, he's obviously, that's kind of history, and he's got this new job. He came in on his bike.
He despite the fact that the weather outside was frightful.
Which, are we gonna start singing a duet?
No.
That's a Christmas song.
I know.
No, it was good. He was cool. And I kind of, I one question I didn't ask him. Why are cyclists so damn self-righteous some of the time? We ran out of time. But anyway, you know what I mean?
It's a controversial one to ask in this building.
There's a lot of aggression.
There's a lot of cyclists in this building.
I'm going to get run over on the way out of the building, aren't
I? You really are.
I'm going to have two tyre tracks down my back. I've got to go and pick up my foldable bike, actually.
Well, more to point. I loved Rashid and Ahmed. They're brilliant. Yeah. And Brown Book is one of those publications that is just a joy.
Yeah, and they're really good boys, and they're very good at talking about it and kind of making sense of it. And as we had said when we were speaking to them, I think it's one of those things, the cultural side and the everyday cultural side is like really overlooked amongst all the big news stories, as we said. And they're always welcome to come in here. They're rock and roll.
They really are. They are indeed.
Cool. Well, that's it for edition 194 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be here again next Sunday. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield.
Thanks for tuning in.